Do we do an example of that with the closet pole?
Yes, you might, but there's no, not today. You might see it another day, or you might see a drift, or you might see a helical dipole, or you might see nonlinear magnets don't really fit into this entire scheme, so anything linear is fair game, but I have the feeling you'll see something that looks straight, familiar and straightforward, which means it probably is something like a quadrupole. Yes, maybe. So, but working through it, you can think about it, right? I mean, you can work out what what's the vector potential of a quadrupole. Well, it's got to be longitudinal, right? Remember, all transverse fields have a sub x and a sub y equals 0. Because I can derive any constant transverse field from a purely longitudinal vector potential. So let's work this out because it's given to you in the exam, right? So what's the vector potential of a quadrupole? Okay, this is page 3. So what is the vector potential of a quadrupole? Well, let's see. So a quadrupole happens to look like this, and let's say this is a north pole, this is a south pole, a north pole, and a south pole. I've got my field lines that look like these things. Field lines go from south to north, at least on this planet. Okay. And that means that, for example, along the midplane here, b sub y is equal to some b0 times x times y, you know, and the y hat is just indicating b sub y, of course. So I'll cross that out. And b sub x, okay, I go along this direction at least. So this is b sub y is equal to b zero x, where for the plane y equals 0. And b sub x is equal to b sub 0 y for the plane x equals 0. Right? So far, so good. Now remember, I had said that the magnetic field is equal to. Does anybody remember? Is there a minus in there or not? There's no minus? Okay, that's. I keep on getting my gauges mixed up, so I'll cross out the minus earlier. Thank you. So this is del cross A, right? So you write this down in terms of the partial with respect to x, the partial with respect to y, the partial with respect to z. This is, let's see, hold it a second. Actually, to do a, I want the unit vectors in here first, right? So x hat, y hat, z hat, partial x, partial y, partial z. And then this is a sub x, a sub y, a sub z. Have you guys seen this way of doing a cross product with a determinant? Okay. So, or a sub s, as the case may be. And you know you can write this, or you can solve this in a way where these two guys are equal 0. So this makes this a lot easier, right? This is x hat partial with respect to y of a sub s minus y hat partial with respect to x of a sub s. Right, so now that means that, gosh, this is an x component up here, so that's b sub 0 y. This is a y component up there, so that's b sub 0, b sub y. So what I end up getting is I end up, if I compare these and look at them, I end up getting something like the this implying that A sub S is equal to something like, gosh, what? It's is it 1/2? Well, there's a B zero out in front, definitely. There's a 2 because the partial with respect to y of A sub s is the x component here. So B0, 2, x squared plus y squared. And is it plus or is it minus? I think it's a minus, right? Certainly the derivative of this with respect to y is positive. The derivative of this with respect to... there's got to be a minus in there somewhere. Right, the, let's see. I want both of these to be positive. This ends up being the x component, derivative of this with respect to y better be positive. The derivative of this with respect to x better be positive as well, so there's a minus in there. That's what it is. Right? Now, if you're clever, and I know you're clever, you go back to the original Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian now applies because we're looking at a transverse magnetic field with only a longitudinal component of the vector potential, right? So this potential here looks like x squared and y squared. It looks just like a simple harmonic oscillator, right? That is the potential energy in a simple harmonic oscillator as the as your spring is stretched or whatever, right? So and one of them looks like, you know, a simple harmonic oscillator that's pushing out. One of them looks like a simple harmonic oscillator that's pushing in because the signs are different. What a surprise. You put that in here, and you end up getting a Hamiltonian that looks like something that's got a potential energy term that goes like x squared and y squared, simple harmonic oscillator. And then the kinetic term out here, you know, 1/2, you know, mv squared, right? Kind of a velocity squared as well. So all of this stuff, you end up getting simple harmonic oscillator terms, which means when you end up writing out Hamilton's equations and doing the matrix stuff that we just did, A, everything decouples. X and Y completely decouple. B, you end up getting matrix 2x2 matrices that you can start multiplying out and realizing that, gosh, they look just like cosines and sines. And the ending up solutions look just like simple harmonic oscillators, which is exactly the motion inside a quad. And you end up connecting this stuff right back to Hill's equation, which is simple harmonic oscillator, partial, you know, kind of segmented up or chopped up into individual regions of constant focusing where it's periodic. So you'll see this again, and you will work through that. If you work through it beforehand, you'll know what to do, and you should just consult your notes. I may, in fact, throw a little curveball in there now so you don't just write it all out and hand it in on Thursday as an answer to that problem now that I've given you that much of a lead, right? So there has to be something that you write down with some creativity on Thursday. But you see how to do it. Equals smiley face, exactly. So as long as you have unique, you know, unique symbols rather than just making everything alpha or xi or xi or whatever that Greek letter is, then you're good. So did that answer your question? Even better.
Will we have to worry about del and c dependence for the exam?
What dependence?
Or del and c, delta and...
Oh. There's only if you are explicitly asked to.
Okay.
Okay. there is, in other words, you know, for something like the quadrupole, it actually is not that trivial, right? The transverse motion is something that you can work through in 20 minutes or 15, 10 minutes or whatever. The longitudinal dependences that fit into the matrix form are for a quadrupole at least, are basically trivial. It ends up being something like a unit matrix. So not exactly so, but close. Okay. And that is because, so this will not be on the exam, but this is to clarify based on the question that you just asked. Okay. So what I am about to talk about, as I am about to wax prosaic on a drift, and this is now a 6D drift with relativity. Okay. And that is not, that smiley face does not mean anything else other than the smiley face at this point. So we had learned before, at least, that, you know, I've got this particle that starts out with a constant angle. So it's got this x prime, and this is kind of, you know, the delta x. If this is over a length that is a drift, that is field free, then that delta x is just L times x prime. And so what I can do is I can write down something now like x prime 2. I can write down a matrix, and here's x1 and x1 prime. Okay. And this is location 1, this is location 2. Well, does the angle change? Nah, particle never bends. So the angle never changes, so x2 prime and x1 prime better be the same thing. There better be no dependence of this thing on position. So there's a zero there. And x2 better be equal to x2 prime, better be equal to x1 prime, so there better be a 1 there. Now here, of course, you know, x2 is equal to, you know, x1 plus this L delta x prime, right? That delta x is really x2 minus x1. And that x prime is whatever x prime it was, because it doesn't change. So there's an L here, and this is that drift matrix. Okay. And in fact, this is that drift matrix also in the y direction. And in the y direction, y1. There's no coupling, right? X doesn't talk to Y. Y doesn't talk to X because they're defined orthogonally, at least. So all of this is fine. However, now we get to coordinates like Z, and remember, delta was defined as P minus P0 divided by P0, right? This is delta is a momentum offset. And these are the coordinates. Right, you can think of delta, it really is literally like an angle in longitudinal space, because it's the rate at which my longitudinal position is changing relative to the design particle. So if everybody's moving exactly in lockstep together, my delta is zero. If I'm moving a little bit faster, I've got a little bit more momentum, I've got positive delta, that's like what I end up accruing over time is a positive Z, a positive location relative to the design particle, right? And so just like, you know, the drift, you'd expect there to be something that this is Z2 and delta 2, this is Z1 and delta 1. Well, the drift doesn't change my momentum, so it doesn't change this stuff. Just like the drift didn't change my angle, I sure expect a 0, 1 in those, in that row. It's the top row that ends up being a little bit funny. Because now it's not just the length, okay? the units work out, it turns out, right? Z has length coordinates and delta is this unitless thing, just like x and x prime and y prime, length and dimensionless, length and dimensionless. So here I'm going to write down L in there because it damn well better depend on L. But it turns out, well, in relativity, there's this funny little thing about length contraction, right? And I end up getting, it turns out, not even a gamma, but if you work the math out carefully with the P's in here and the Z's in here and the lab frame versus the relative frame, there's actually a delta squared, or a gamma squared in there, where this gamma is, of course, the relativistic gamma, 1 minus beta squared, where beta is defined as V over C, right? So, and this is just for a drift, right? This is a tricky thing just for a drift, is that there is a bit of a correction there. And it turns out that for very relativistic particles, this thing, you know, goes to zero as, you know, gamma becomes much, much greater than one. And so magically what happens is, you see this with electrons in our big accelerator, all of the electrons, as their kind of longitudinal distribution gets shaped at the low energy and the low energy side of the accelerator, but as soon as they go through enough accelerating stuff and get enough energy, that distribution freezes, like literally freezes, and it becomes the same longitudinal distribution throughout the entire machine because the entire rest of the machine is hugely relativistically contracted. It looks to the electrons like there's almost no time to evolve, even going through multiple kilometers of accelerator. So that's, you know, kind of a cool little thing, and it crops up because you say, do we need to worry about the deltas and the Zs? No, but let me tell you a story, kids, right? Because there is, you know, interesting insight to be had by putting together the drift and relativity. And it's not this, you know, you kind of got a gut feeling for what this stuff is like just from drawing a little picture. But the longitudinal space, you start to have to get a little careful with. Fair? And look at the random things you learn in accelerator class. Let's see, what else is there? Among the material that we've covered, okay, I just mentioned there's going to be something field-like. There's been a fairly strong emphasis recently on things like the, on intraconverting between the photo lattice, multiply the matrices together, and the betas for the periodic solution, right? So expect that there will be something like magnets. Got some arrangement of magnets here. Periodic description of the system here, I cosine mu. So this is periodic, plus J sine mu. So this is the periodic solution. And matching these two things together by multiplying out these matrices and then taking the trace, et cetera, and figuring out what the betas and the alphas are from these things based on these lengths and these focal lengths and other parameters there. I expect there will be a little work through like that, because that is quite literally the culmination of a lot of the first half of the semester. Don't expect there to be a problem on, hey, here's a magnet and design the magnet. You went through some of that in the homework with that window frame dipole and figure it out, cooling and stuff like that. It's a good exercise to do, but I'm much more interested, you know, designing a magnet is kind of, if you're going to be a high energy physicist or a nuclear physicist or even a solid state physicist building a magnet in a lab, yeah, you'll learn how to do that someday, but the general dynamics stuff is the stuff that I like trying to teach and pound into people, because periodic focusing systems are everywhere. So you'll probably see something like this. You'll see something like the Hamiltonian turned into the transport matrix for a particular type of optical system, then you might have a surprise. Because I can't give all of my secrets away at once. So let's see, and then. Yes, and then you have spring break next week already. Is anybody going anywhere for spring break? I am. I'm going to Jefferson Lab because I work there. Yeah, you know. There is an open house May 19th, I think, is the date.
That's a physics open house.
So, is there... May 19th. No. There's an open house here for students earlier than that, for the incoming graduate students. The Jefferson Lab open house is May 19th. So J Lab open house... Yep. May 19th. It's a Saturday. There is, if you're planning on going, talk to your teacher and he may get you a special tour or something like that. Or you can just come by anytime because you guys live here and it's only up the road, right?
Just knock on the door.
Yeah, right. Any old time and say, hey, Todd told me to come by. And they'll know to call the police.
The physics open house here is March 17th.
Yep, that's March, not May. So there is, right, exactly. So for the JLab open house, definitely you will be able to get into the big accelerator. So CBAF will be open, and that means you can get into the experimental halls and see some of the experiments that some of your other professors here work on, and you'll be able to go down and see real quadrupoles and real dipoles and real RF cryo modules and the control room and things like that. So all of it will be accessible. But it is after the class is over, right? We finish class in mid-April. So that's not that far from now. That's a month and a half from now or so. Yeah, I know. It's crazy, isn't it, that we only have after spring break, we have 6 weeks. 6 weeks of class left. And then we're done. There's So at these open houses, we often have several thousand people come through. So it's more like not how many signatures you get, but how many people you know that might actually be there, that might recognize you, and therefore get a little more animated and jump up and down when they see you and explain more stuff. Right. So there's there's. It is a very full day, and it is kind of all hands on deck at the lab, and there are a lot of people that come through. So it's a little bit hard to get special attention. On the other hand, the accelerator's down all summer, and that means that there are opportunities for other tours, particularly since you guys are all older than 21 in principle. That means that given just a little bit of lead time, I can put you on a guest list and come show you the tunnel, you know, any time off of that too. So it's not a big deal, something I'm happy to do, except then you have to listen to me lecture some more, and by mid-April you'll be really tired of me. A comment about student presentations. If we, in fact, have as many students as, I mean, I think 9 people are signed up for the class, something like that, right? So we might actually have to split it up into 2 of the classes in the last week, because I think something like a 7-minute presentation is not very effective. generally, they're 12 to 15 minutes is what I ask for about the topic of your choosing and my approval. And it could be something, some application of accelerators. After the spring break, I'll give everybody a list, and there's kind of a sign-up. But you can also add your own topics if there's some reason why you were interested in this particular topic or this particular course. So I'll do that after spring break when we come back. And like I mentioned, after spring break, the narrative of this first section that I came back for, at least, was all about this linear optics, all about connecting the Tinker toys, looking at the periodic solutions, doing the boundary conditions and the mechanisms and language that we use to write down that stuff. The second half of the semester, I, you know, by its very nature, is a little bit schizophrenic. It's we're talking about longitudinal motion, this longitudinal motion now in a more formal way. That's a couple of classes. We're talking about synchrotron radiation, what happens when charged particles bend in magnetic fields. That is a little bit of a preview of graduate level E&M, and you may have even covered it, some of it in undergrad at least, but it is very relevant for how modern light sources are designed. And there's a nice set of lectures that I have that connects this stuff, the lattice optics stuff that we've done with how electron beams radiate their synchrotron radiation, and how do you make that synchrotron radiation bright by designing the lattice the right way. And all of that stuff, it actually comes right to the current generation of light source accelerators in the world, and upgrades that are going on now at Argonne, at Berkeley Lab, and a very, very fancy machine that I'll tell you guys about called MAX-4 in Sweden, which is being built right next to ESS. So by that time, you'll have enough understanding of the optics and synchrotron radiation, at least have been exposed to enough, that I will be talking through some papers that are written in the past 10 years instead of this stuff, which is written 50 years ago. So we'll, you know, that whets your appetite. But first, we have a midterm to get through, and that shouldn't be a horrible midterm in principle.
Will we have homeworks for the midterm, or is that not?
There is no. So I'm a firm believer in everybody should enjoy their spring break, except me, because I have lots of grading to catch up on and lots of work to do on lectures for the upcoming stuff. But you guys, and go enjoy your spring break. How many of you are seniors? Yeah, go enjoy your spring breaks. So sorry, but because I also understand that you're all taking a lot of credits, and other courses may have other things due right after spring break or other exams coming up as well. Don't worry about me packing on the homework too much. However, when we do get to the second half of the semester, we'll probably get back to weekly homework rather than just 3 homework so far, because I do need some statistics to be able to differentiate grades a little. And it'll probably be more like 2 problems every week, but there'll be problems every week rather than 3 problems every 2 weeks or something like that, like it's been. Okay? Any other questions? You guys want to get out of here? It's only 15 minutes early.
Will we have will we have any problems like number 2 for homework 1, where we had to figure out the kinetic energy?
Oh yeah. That one is it's very, very close to a plug and chug, this one, right? The Rick energy and current
number.
that there's that particular homework is I use this as an introductory thing just to get people used to the numbers and to manipulating the numbers. I generally don't like things like that for midterm problems, certainly at not this level, because something like that is more like, you know, 231, 232. You either get it right or you get it wrong. But there's not a whole lot of understanding. There's not a whole lot of process that can be graded to give partial credit, right?
Yeah.
And I much prefer seeing a process and seeing you write down, this is how I'm thinking about this problem and this is what I've learned about this problem, because then I can give lots of partial credit even if you don't get all the way there. Or I can correct your thinking because I can see the process again. Upper level courses should all be about mentoring your thought processes and how you connect the dots of the material, rather than can you turn the crank or not turn the crank. Okay.
And what about like beta trauma, cyclotron specific questions?
There probably won't be many of those either. I mean, that was again, you know, introductory material to get you thinking about motion in magnetic fields and circular coordinates type things. It started the material, but it didn't connect as deeply into things like, okay, the symplectic approach to figuring out transport matrices is really interesting, and it's a nice thing to know. And the ability to connect lattices of magnets to the parameterization, both of those are big topics that we've spent multiple lectures on. So things like that, research more of the material that I've taught and less of the material that Drs. Kraft and Hyde taught. I can't speak to Suba's lecture. There may be something about dispersion, because I did talk through dispersion, and we went through it in multiple classes. So you should have some understanding of, you know, at least read through the book material and the lecture material and get a feeling for what that manipulation was like. Okay? Fair enough.